Well, hello again, everyone, and thank you for joining today's teleclass, Norovirus Outbreaks, Issues and Interventions. My name is Paul Weber. My colleague and the co-founder of Teleclass Education is Professor Syed Sattar, and on his behalf and mine, I'd like to welcome you to what will undoubtedly be a fantastic lecture. At the Chica Canada conference a couple weeks ago, I counted 8 lectures and no fewer than 10 posters that referenced the work of Dr. Philip Carling, and those were just the lectures that I actually attended. To say that this man is renowned is in no small measure an understatement of the impact that his research has had. Dr. Carling is a physician director of the Infection Prevention and Control Program at the Kearney Hospitals in Boston. He is a professor at the Boston University School of Medicine. He is the author of a great many papers and book chapters, and he is a popular speaker at conferences around the globe. I think I've attended 3 conferences in different countries where he's been speaking. I'm really pleased that he will be able and willing to join us for this teleclass lecture. In fact, this is the 2nd of his lectures in 2010. Before Dr. Carling begins, I would also like to acknowledge and thank Virox Technologies for their support of this teleclass and their continuing support of the teleclass education program as a whole. So now to present Norovirus Outbreaks, Issues and Interventions from the beautiful Boston University School of Medicine, I am pleased to introduce Dr. Philip Carling. Dr. Carling.
Thank you so much for such a nice introduction, Paul. Today's presentation on the first slide, just a quick outline of where we're going to be going and talking about norovirus biology, its epidemiology, a little bit about clinical features, and this whole issue of why norovirus outbreaks are such a problem in healthcare settings, as they've been recognized over the past decade and a half, particularly. A little bit about cruise ship issues in particular, because it's an important norovirus problem area, and also because I've had the opportunity to think specifically about cruise ships and hygienic practices, as I'll tell you about in a little while. And lastly, what can we do to prevent norovirus outbreaks? Where is this going, since they're so difficult to manage once they start? So a little bit about norovirus biology. The virus was really not discovered until late 1960s because it can't be grown. The human norovirus only lives in humans and only infects human cells. There has been some work just in the last year that may have made it possible to do some culturing of human norovirus, but that's not really been reported in any detail yet that I've seen. It's a hope that to be possible because it'll allow for better study of the biology of the virus. But it really was because of an outbreak of acute gastroenteritis in a whole bunch of school children over a short period of time that stool specimens were saved in the 1960s. They tried hard to culture what looked like a viral infection, and they tried hard to culture the specimens but weren't able to culture it. And in 1971, somebody was smart enough to start to think about the issue. They had found, by the way, in the late 1960s, that they could see the virus under electron microscopy pictures, such as the one shown on the slide, and therefore they kept trying to figure out ways of studying the illness. In the early 1970s, a number of researchers got together and took stool specimens, filtered them through millipore filters so that all bacterial or cell origin material was removed, and gave these to volunteers that were at the time primarily prisoners, although subsequently non-prisoners were used to study norovirus. It's the kind of thing that we wouldn't do nowadays for ethical reasons, and of course because of concerns about other viruses that in those days we didn't really think too much about as the viruses that we couldn't see or culture, such as, of course, HIV and other ones that we would maybe even don't know about today. So these kind of studies would never be done again. But I will come back to them because they did define the illness in a very, very clear way and some very interesting and unique aspects of norovirus illness. We now know by studying the genetic structure of these viruses that there are hundreds of strains, and that's one of the reasons that people can get norovirus infection over and over again. It's also the reason that when you travel, you have a high propensity for getting a norovirus infection because the strains that you're being exposed to are not the ones that you've been exposed to more recently where you live. the next slide basically is to say, what does norovirus really look like? Well, I was trying to figure out a better picture, and so I found this one and thought that maybe this is an interesting virus. I also liked this following slide, that maybe it's the virus that's going around. That certainly looks like the kind of thing that we would like to blame unpleasant infections like norovirus on, a creature like that. A little bit about epidemiology on the next slide. There's many challenges in trying to get a handle on this virus, and one of them is the fact that it's continuing to evolve. It now turns out that the RNA in the virus, it's an RNA virus, the RNA is particularly error-prone for some reason. Nobody really knows why, but it's more error-prone than the usual case would be, and that base pairs get dropped or mixed up more frequently than once every million divisions or million virons, which is the biological average, if you will. So that therefore we have a relatively unstable virus. There's also been found now recombination between strains, like with other viruses that we've heard about over the years. And I think it's very analogous to influenza, that basically that there are these strains that seem to go around the world of a certain genetic makeup, and then sub-strains of that type, and then they tend to wane, and another strain comes and makes for more infections and more outbreaks, and then they tend to back off both locally and sometimes globally. And so it's a cyclic thing for substantial, not completely, it never goes away. But it comes in waves, if you will, a little bit like influenza every 2 to 4 years. There is a little bit of winter increase, particularly in temperate climates, but this is not an absolute by any means. Next slide, talking about sporadic cases. You know, it's listed among foodborne illnesses. A norovirus infection is called a foodborne illness. But it's important to remember it's not a foodborne illness in the traditional sense, in as much as the virus does not replicate in food. It can contaminate food, but it doesn't live in the food. It really occurs when fresh foods are served undercooked that have been contaminated by food handlers whose hands have been contaminated by norovirus, either symptomatically or asymptomatically. Interestingly, the first study that's actually finally shown that food handlers' hands with norovirus on them can actually transmit norovirus was just shown recently with PCR studies of norovirus infection in an ongoing outbreak. But it was been suspected epidemiologically for quite a while that was true. We'll come back to asymptomatic shedding, which is unfortunately a major factor in the epidemiology of norovirus infection. There are a few exceptions where basically the virus can be inside the food, such as shellfish, because of contaminated drinking water, or the drinking water itself can be contaminated with sewage enough to transmit norovirus. And as we'll talk about later, it doesn't take much in the terms of numbers of norovirus virons to cause an infection. And so water has been associated with a few outbreaks. It's not common, but it has been seen and well documented. Further about sporadic cases, I thought this was interesting. What's wrong with this picture is my question. I call it the key reason that food gets contaminated. As you can see from the caption just above the picture there, this is a picture of some Royal Marines looking, at least that one, looking like he's having a good time teaching catering students how to, quote, beat the bugs in the kitchen. I don't know exactly how he's teaching them to beat the bugs because, of course, what's wrong with the picture? If you look closely in the next slide, hopefully you can see it on your computer screens, that nobody's wearing gloves and nobody's wearing disposable gloves. I think that's really unfortunate. I'm sure that in many parts of the world, that's more the case than it is in some other parts of the world where food handlers routinely handle food without donning those little vinyl disposable gloves that are so commonly used in many food preparation restaurants and facilities. But if people don't use that, the chances of passing norovirus are not insignificant. It's really more for norovirus than anything else because of the problems I'll talk about in a minute in terms of transmission. Susceptibility to norovirus infection on the next slide. One of the curious things that's just been discovered in the past decade is that certain blood group antigens, histoblood group antigens, of your genetic makeup, all of us contain certain antigenic makeups that relate to blood antigens, and those are actually expressed on the surfaces of GI cells as well as other cells in our body and act as receptor sites for norovirus. And it turns out that certain of these genetic antigenic sites are different enough so that you are not prone to norovirus infection. In other words, some people are actually sort of immune, if you will, intrinsically immune to norovirus infection. And it's one of the reasons that you'll see some family members, for example, with a cluster of norovirus infection, get ill and spread their norovirus around extensively in the environment, have uncontrolled vomiting and diarrhea, and that other family members get heavily exposed but don't get ill. And it turns out it's because they had different histocompatibility antigens. Those antigens are the ones that seem to be associated with inability for norovirus to cause infection, seem to be more common in northern Europeans than in folks in other parts of the world, but that's still being worked out. It's probably a more complex story than that. Very young people, very old, and chronically ill people are certainly more susceptible to infection. The reason probably is, although not completely studied, is due to decreased gastric acid in these groups. Therefore, the more virons get past the stomach than would otherwise be the case, and the ability to infect the person is therefore increased. Travelers, I mentioned before, have new strain exposure. And lastly, the immunity is very short-lived. It's about 2 to 3 weeks for fairly good immunity. This was shown with those prisoner studies I mentioned before, where they gave exactly the same strain back to people repeatedly. They found that after 2 or 3 weeks, the patients, the volunteers, became ill again with the same strain. The next slide talks a little bit about norovirus infection itself. I think one of the most critical things for everybody listening to the program today to remember is that norovirus is probably one of the most infectious agents that we deal with at all on a regular basis. That it's been shown clearly that very small numbers of virus particles can cause a clinical infection. That there's literature to support less than 10. There's another article that went down as low as 15 to 50 virons, but whatever it is, it's extremely small considering the incredible number of virons that are shed in somebody who's symptomatic, and we'll come back to that later on, but they're in the billions per gram of stool, and so it's not at all surprising that this is such an effective infectious agent, and that's one of the major reasons. The incubation period, there's another major reason we'll come to in a few minutes, but one of the ones is that the infective dose is very, very low. Incubation period is approximately 10 to 51 hours, fairly short incubation. Most cases are in the 24-hour range of incubation. But importantly, again, with the epidemiology of this organism, is that about 30% of cases, there's shedding of the virus before a symptomatic illness, that it can be found in the GI tract before symptomatic illness. And that is one of the reasons that, again, it's such a good pathogen in terms of spreading and causing outbreaks, is that asymptomatic shedding begins before infection begins. And, secondly, it continues for weeks. We like to think that it only continues for 3 or 4 days, and we'll talk later about isolation and healthcare worker issues. But despite the fact that we like to make believe that folks are not infectious that get this illness after about 3 or 4 days, that's not true, particularly in children, particularly in elderly, and particularly, most particularly in compromised individuals, such as the ones that would get it in a hospital outbreak or a long-term care facility outbreak, which are common areas of epidemic outbreaks. An interesting report here on the next slide shows norovirus shedding in renal stem cell recipients. It's a little bit hard to follow. I'm sorry, this slide is a little bit challenging, but let me take you through it. The article is a very interesting one. It basically shows these 12 individuals that came down with norovirus infection and what their natural history was, because, of course, there is no treatment. The dark bar with the point on the right-hand end of it is representative of the duration of illness, of diarrhea. And as you can see down at the bottom, we're talking months and months and months and over a year in that one patient of symptomatic infection. The dark triangles indicate situations where they did the PCR on the stool and found heavy concentrations of norovirus, and the gray, hard to see a little bit maybe, the lighter triangles are less heavily contaminated but still contaminated stool specimens, and the white triangles where there's no contamination. As you can see, there's a variability here. There's that some of these folks that are symptomatic do continue to shed virus, as you might guess. folks that become asymptomatic can have lower numbers of virus and then finally clear it. The little cross circle with a cross in the center of it is when steroids were stopped in these patients. So they thought that maybe steroids were increasing the duration of the illness, but it's obviously hard to say what they did one way or the other. But as you can also see, there have been some relapse cases that were asymptomatic relapses. Number three is an asymptomatic relapse after a short illness. It was gone in the stool on a couple of occasions, then it came again, and then it was gone again. And there was also the other one where the patient became symptomatic again, number seven, where they were ill for a tremendous period of time and then became symptomatic again. Here it is 27 months later, that poor individual. So it's just an illustration, the best study that's ever been done, actually, on the actual, on the true epidemiology of norovirus infection in compromised patients. The next slide, a little bit about clinical features. We all know, well, anybody wanting to listen to this talk knows that the major symptoms are nausea and vomiting from norovirus infection. And it's usually the first symptom, sometimes one and sometimes the others. I'll show you in a minute. But I put in bold there, vomiting is the alarm symptom, particularly in outbreak settings. I think it's the one thing infectious disease physicians and particularly infection prevention practitioners can keep in mind when trying to alert people and trying to educate medical staff and nursing staff about how to watch out for evolving norovirus outbreaks in their healthcare settings particularly, is to watch out for the vomiting. Now, it's true that many patients, with all the medications we give them, get nausea. Many times illnesses cause nausea, sometimes vomiting. But the difference, of course, is that if it's more than one patient on a unit that's been vomiting, particularly if they develop diarrhea as well, then right away you ought to be thinking norovirus. It's, I think, the most helpful of the symptoms that a patient can have that's fairly distinctive if you particularly have more than one patient in a short period of time developing vomiting that otherwise was clinically stable. This is particularly helpful in long-term care settings where, in general, the patients are relatively stable over time. And if you have all of a sudden two or three people on a single unit that have developed vomiting and diarrhea, it's norovirus till proven otherwise. The cramps and diarrhea, there's nothing particularly unique about them. There's no blood and no increased white cells in the stool. If you are thinking about C. diff and looking for white cells, for example, the onset sometimes is very rapid and explosive and can be quite severe. Hospitalization is not uncommonly necessary for dehydration, especially in nursing home patients. And as we might mention later on, mortality is also seen from time to time in such patients. It's usually because it basically is the straw that breaks the camel's back in patients with other medical problems. Fever is common, but only common in about half of people, and it's usually not very impressive fever. The duration of acute illness in healthy patients is only a couple of days, but unfortunately, the acute illness in chronically ill and elderly patients is up closer towards a week for the most part, and as pointed out just a minute ago, with more immunocompromised patients, it can go on for weeks and months. The next slide, the slide that says norovirus clinical features, was taken from the work of Drs. Dolan, Blacklow, and DuPont in 1971 in the prisoner volunteers, and is a very clear example of a unique aspect of norovirus infection. And what it shows here is that the same viral strain taken from one previous individual was given to two other individuals, volunteer 1 and volunteer 2, as it says there. If you look at volunteer 1's illness, they were challenged on the first day, and within a very short period of time developed fever. By roughly a little over 24 hours later, had a low-grade fever, again 101, nothing spectacular, but definitely a fever, which didn't, interestingly enough, last very long. But as you can see, they had severe vomiting. They had 20 episodes of vomiting on their first and second day of illness, and then it was gone, completely gone. It wasn't, you can see the peak there is very nicely shown in the shading. It's a very sharp peak of really 24 hours of vomiting. Abdominal cramps were longer, at least preceded the vomiting, nausea as well as the patient not feeling well. But again, you look at the duration of the illness, it was brief. The headache, myalgias were there, again, centered around that 24-hour period after the ingestion. Now, interestingly enough, the patient's WBC count was moderately elevated, 18,000 on the first day, down to 16, and then quickly normalized. But that's sort of curious and not common for many viral infections to see a white count elevation. It might have been due to the stress of the vomiting as an adrenaline reaction. I think that's a likelihood, but we'll never know for sure in this patient. Volunteer number two, though, is very curious. With the same viral strain, you can see that, number one, the incubation period was a little bit longer. There wasn't much fever at all, barely up to 100 only on one occasion. And this person had all kinds of diarrhea, ate stools during a little more protracted period, 2 days, and no vomiting at all. Whereas looking back at the other patient, there was no diarrhea, but severe vomiting. And then you can see the other symptoms as outlined. And fortunately, a brief duration of illness was again illustrated. But I think that these two patients, and the reason, of course, the researchers put this very thoughtful and carefully done graphic together, is to illustrate the fact that the same virus can cause very different symptoms in two different patients. Of course, there are many patients that have both diarrhea and vomiting, but unfortunately, it's not everybody. And so it's, again, important when you're trying to be concerned about picking up a norovirus outbreak as soon as possible, especially in a closed environment like a cruise ship or a long-term care facility, that some people may have only vomiting and some people may have only diarrhea. If you're looking for both, you might not necessarily see it. So important, I think, clinical features to keep in mind. The next slide goes on to some things about complications. They do occur. People used to say norovirus is, it's just that mild crud that's really severe that once you're over it, thank goodness, but it doesn't, it's severe while it lasts, but it doesn't last too long. Well, it doesn't last too long in most healthy adults, but enterocolitis can occur in infants. Interestingly enough, seizures in children. I hadn't been very much aware of this until a year or so ago, hearing about children in Japan with norovirus infection. It wasn't a different strain of norovirus, or at least evidently very different from other strains, has been circulating a couple of years ago, the G2 type -4 strains. But a number of children had seizures associated with their symptoms. And of course, you'd say, well, seizures in children, that's because they had high fever. Well, they didn't have high fever. That's because they were dehydrated. No, they weren't that dehydrated. And interestingly enough, in preparing for this talk, I came across an abstract, the paper hasn't been published yet, that actually found particles of norovirus in children's blood when they were having seizures. They saw PCR positive and then found the particles. So it's a curious thing, and not a very common one. And was it unique to the strains, or was it unique to some genetic issue where the folks were maybe more genetically similar than different in a country like Japan? I don't know yet. It's a curious phenomenon. Chronic colitis, as we just pointed out a few minutes ago, is a really serious problem when it occurs, and there's no treatment for it. Mortality, as I say, is well recognized, but is really host-dependent, fortunately. There's more data now, particularly from England, where they've been following norovirus outbreaks and watching them, particularly in long-term care facilities, that has shown significant mortality with these outbreaks. Not in the range of 10%, but in the range of 5% in some of the outbreaks in long-term care facilities. These are some of the settings where the outbreak phenomenon of norovirus clustering and local epidemics, if you will, have been best studied. Hospitals we know about, extended care facilities, some very good studies published in the last couple of years looking carefully at the epidemiology and the causality issues in extended care facilities. Cruise ships we'll talk about in a little more detail. Every level of school, from daycare centers on through colleges, have had norovirus problems from time to time. Restaurants, for the reasons we pointed out before, mostly because of a restaurant worker not using proper personal hygiene and spreading it to customers that way. Hotels have been associated with outbreaks. Concert halls is mentioned because one of the most vivid outbreaks to ever been studied occurred in Britain a number of years ago, where a single person became ill and vomiting and diarrhea, and in the concert hall with other people coming over several days, other groups of people exposed to the environment came down with norovirus infection. So it can happen in that kind of setting. military installations, a number of outbreaks most recently studied in Germany, have occurred in military installations. Looking more specifically for a few minutes at cruise ships, because I think they do provide us an opportunity to think about the epidemiology and also some causality issues that we'll then go into more detail afterwards. The next slide, the first outbreaks were recognized in the 1950s. They didn't know what it was due to, but in retrospect, there were norovirus outbreaks at the time. The CDC in the 1970s in this country became involved with cruise ship sanitation concerns. Interestingly enough, not so much because of norovirus, but in the 1970s it was just starting to be recognized as a defined illness, but because of salmonella outbreaks and poor food handling practices on cruise ships that were based in the United States and sometimes were owned and operated by companies outside the United States without the same kind of hygienic standards. And so the CDC became involved in a sanitation program that they've been actively working with the cruise lines that have ships based in the U.S. for the past 30 years now, actually. The program consists primarily of inspections of the ships twice a year that are semi-unannounced. They evaluate, according to standards, many aspects of sanitary practice on the ships. They look at food handling, food preparation, food storage, a swimming pool, water safety maintenance, rodent protection. Many other safety issues about the ships are being monitored by the CDC. It also was decided several years ago that ships that started experiencing more than 2% of passengers with gastroenteritis illnesses would be required to report their findings and how many people became ill and the nature of the outbreak to the CDC. When that happens, the CDC then sends a team to the ship that issues such a report and reviews the ship's practices, reviews the outbreak, and tries to determine what it's caused by. And because of the ability now to diagnose norovirus in GI secretions, particularly diarrhea, with PCR, it's been possible to determine that actually almost all acute gastroenteritis illnesses on cruise ships are due to norovirus. About 90-some percent in most recent years have been monitored. Once in a while, rotaviruses, and once in a great while, they aren't able to determine the etiology. We do know that about 10 to 20 outbreaks a year occur on U.S.-based vessels. All this information is available on the CDC's website. That's the vessel inspection part of the CDC website. And you can go there and you can evaluate the ship's assessment by the inspection scores, and you can look at outbreaks to see what the cause of the outbreak was and how many outbreaks a certain ship had during a period of time. You can evaluate those kind of facts. It's all public record for everybody to look at and understand. The whole issue in the cruise ship industry is a bit of a challenging one for the industry to deal with. Norovirus infections are so common among every population, among all of us, that a vessel having, let's say, 1,000 or 1,500 passengers on it, somebody's going to have norovirus infection. And maybe that's, you know, just their unfortunate luck that day to have norovirus infection when they go on a cruise. Unfortunately, there is evidence that sanitary cleaning practices maybe are a potential factor in the outbreaks that tend to occur, and I'll come to that in a second. But curiously enough, about 20% of the vessels that have had outbreaks are the same vessels that have had outbreaks in the recent past. There's been a problem both in Britain in 2009, early 2010, with a ship that had multiple outbreaks. There's been a problem with a ship in the U.S. Out of Charleston, South Carolina, this past winter that's had multiple outbreaks, despite efforts of trying to clean the ship and do things to prevent recurrent transmission. It's occurred in these two most recent instances. I know others are seen and are being in the process of being evaluated. Unfortunately, there is a potential for some cruise lines to blame the passengers and just say it's a passenger problem, it's not a cruise line problem. I think that's maybe in light of further evolving evidence, a little bit short-sighted in some cases. Going on to what we looked at is basically using the targeting methodology that was discussed earlier this year. It uses an invisible fluorescent dye to pre-mark objects and then see if they're adequately cleaned, as we've been doing in hospital settings, and as Paul mentioned before, is being looked at in a wider range of healthcare settings, both in the U.S. and abroad. We use this methodology to evaluate 56 cruise ships over 3 years. The folks that did the evaluation were healthcare workers. They were already going on cruises. And basically, I asked them, and they agreed to do covert evaluation of how well the public restrooms on these cruise ships were being cleaned. We looked at only six objects, because we were just looking at restrooms, and they were marked on a daily basis for at least 5 days. 273 restrooms were evaluated, and about 32% of all the U.S. cruise ships by chance were evaluated during the study period. The results on the next slide showed that overall cleaning on a daily basis of various objects was sometimes pretty frequently less than optimal. As you can see, some objects such as toilet seats were cleaned almost about 50% of the time, but the other items around in the toilet area were cleaned less often. Overall, cleaning was under 40% for the objects tested. Interestingly enough, 19 objects on 13 ships were not cleaned at all during the 5 to 7 days they were being monitored. If we looked at individual cruise lines, on the next slide, because everybody, when they hear this information about this, they say, okay, what cruise line should I avoid? Well, I can tell you from this data, as well as further data that we've collected over the past couple of years since the study finished in 2008, that there is no single cruise line that is either that stands out one way or the other as either being, quote, better cleaned or less better cleaned. The issue really is very ship-specific, that some ships, as you can see over on the right-hand side of that chart, their restrooms are really being cleaned pretty darn well to even perfectly, in one ship's case, that everything was cleaned every day all the time. Unfortunately, there are a number of ships on the other side of the graphic that show that a lot of ships are not being cleaned particularly well, at least in their public restroom areas, on a daily basis. The next slide shows basically that sometimes serendipity gives you more information. Although not an objective of our study, I did notice as we were putting together the report of this that a number of the ships inspected by chance had norovirus outbreaks either before or after a chance inspection by one of our research associates was carried out. It just so happened that three ships within a short period of time, a couple of months before a norovirus outbreak, were evaluated, and three ships within a close period of time just after a norovirus outbreak were evaluated. And as you can see, although obviously only six ships were evaluated, there seemed to be a fairly striking difference between how well cleaned the ships were before norovirus outbreaks versus after norovirus outbreaks. This suggests that the good cleaning, which is obviously well above average, was in response to a norovirus outbreak, and that cleaning could be done well on those ships. These aren't the same ships, by the way. All of six ships are actually different ships, so it wasn't the same ship before and after kind of thing. But we did, interestingly, and this has not yet been published, we have had a chance to look at this further, as I'll show you in just a minute. The cruise line industry, after this report was shown, was a bit concerned with the results, but the response was as noted here, and that is that the industry says they've been working hard with the CDC and that public health and sanitation procedures are rigorous and that the vessel sanitation scores were very good. And it's true that the vessel sanitation scores were uniformly very good. All 56 ships had very, very good scores. But the reality is that the CDC's program is focused not so much on daily practice. In fact, it can't be because of the nature of the way they are able to do the program, that it's only episodic inspection and not an ongoing inspection situation. But serendipity happens only if you're there for it. And the next slide shows a problem with a cruise, Caribbean cruise this past March. This was an evaluation that was done by a nurse who had actually done some previous cruises, was experienced in how to use the tools. And when she went on board the ship on day one, the first full day of evaluation, she was able to assess the TDC score, which just is thoroughness of disinfection cleaning score. In other words, the percent of public restroom items that had been cleaned on the, I think it was six restrooms she evaluated. Turns out it was 10% of what those six objects had been cleaned that day. The next slide shows that the first cases of diarrhea on this ship began very shortly after the cruise began. By the second day, passengers were aware that there were a number of people with diarrhea, and the cleaning was a little bit better that day. If you go to the next slide, you can see that over the next couple of days, the cleaning improved a little bit, but not terribly strikingly. The ship did decide to remove salt and pepper from the tables because of concerns that it might be transmitting the norovirus infection. By the fifth inspection, over 40% of things were being cleaned, but as noted by the star, at that time, no high-risk objects, that's HRO means high-risk objects, had been cleaned in 40% of the public restrooms until this point. So the 40% of the restrooms were still going, had not been cleaned during the entire previous inspection period. Subsequently, cleaning on the next slide improved fairly strikingly up to over 80% by day seven, but it was too late. By then, several hundred passengers were sick, and the ship norovirus outbreak was already well advanced by that point. This little series of observations, I think, helps explain why these problems occur in closed settings with norovirus. Because basically, if you have a situation where the environment is not necessarily being optimally disinfection cleaned on a regular basis, it's like a setup, if you will, for an outbreak to rapidly escalate. I consider it's sort of like an amplifier. In other words, if there's a background number of people at any one time in a large population with norovirus infection, there has to be some kind of amplifier to let an outbreak develop. And the evidence is evolving fairly strongly over the last couple of years, with a lot of studies now showing the environmental contamination with norovirus during outbreaks, that it probably is the environment that is the amplifier, if you will, to allow for an outbreak to occur. It doesn't say that it can't be transmitted person to person. It can be within close contact within families, but the environment is probably playing a significant role, I think is likely, from the data that's been evolving and from these kinds of studies. So, why are norovirus outbreaks such a problem in healthcare settings? These are the 10 reasons that we've somewhat gone through, from least important to most important overall, I would say. But they're all important. Just going through the list, we mentioned the new strains are continuously evolving. We know that there's no long-term immunity, as I mentioned before. Vaccine development, because of course we can't grow this virus, is really not moving along very rapidly yet, in fact, at all. Healthcare workers spread one to many. Well, that occurs from sick healthcare workers, and we've seen that even in our hospital here with norovirus outbreaks, where somebody will try to get back to work maybe a little before they should, or are asked to work when they shouldn't be asked to work because they're, quote, not that sick, and then you have more secondary cases. So that's one of the problems. And shedding precedes illness, we mentioned that. Extended shedding, we mentioned that. Another problem is that alcohol-based hand rubs have limited impact. They don't kill norovirus well. They can remove norovirus and decrease its numbers through mechanical action, but the efficacy is relatively less than more. There's been some studies that suggest that certain alcohols are a little more effective than others, but most of the studies of alcohol-based hand rubs as well as disinfectants, which is the next number, have been done with not using human norovirus, but using feline noroviruses, which are similar, but they might have different sensitivities to disinfectants. I'll mention a little bit more about disinfectants in a second. Number two is the infective dose is extremely small. We mentioned that. And environmental survival. We didn't mention that yet. One of the other reasons that the environment is such a problem, and probably again explains why multiple outbreaks in the same vessel or in the same healthcare facility are sometimes seen, is the fact that this virus, unlike essentially almost any other virus that's known, lives better in the innate environment, survives better, is able to still infect cells better than other viruses. Many viruses live on surfaces a bit longer than we'd like to believe. In other words, we'd like to make believe that a cold virus, when it goes onto a doorknob after we've touched it, our hand to our nose, only lives there for a couple of hours. But it turns out that even adenoviruses live for a day or so on surfaces, and that other viruses, hepatitis C virus, it now turns out, survives for weeks on surfaces, and norovirus certainly also can survive for weeks on surfaces. I think, is a major factor in the spread of infection in outbreaks. So, what about bleach? The problem, as I say here, is that there's no evidence-based intervention is yet to be shown effective. Bleach is used, bleach is recommended, and bleach can kill norovirus. But there's no evidence base to support when it's necessary to use bleach, or this goes for many other infections and the use of surface disinfectants, is that we really have not yet done the studies that separate out the product from the process. This whole issue of what's more important, having a product that kills something like norovirus that's hard to kill, or a system that is thorough in terms of making sure that all the surfaces that get contaminated are being cleaned the way they're supposed to be cleaned. It would be nice to suggest that it's a little bit of both, but the answer is we really don't know, and we just haven't done these studies yet. Hopefully now, with a better understanding of the importance of the environment, with ways of looking at how thorough environmental hygiene is being practiced, we can start to parse out what is really critical here in terms of optimizing environmental hygiene and how to do it, and whether it's the product or the process or what proportion of both is yet to be seen with many infectious diseases, not just norovirus. A little more about bleach here. As I said and alluded to before, much more potent in the lab than other disinfectants against norovirus. Many have no effect. You know, quaternary ammoniums have almost no effect on norovirus. Several studies have shown slight clinical impact, but they've had discordant controls. In other words, they've used bleach and said it's worked, but they haven't really had good controls, plus they didn't control for the thoroughness of cleaning. When you have an outbreak, people try harder, just as we just saw with the cruise ship illustration a few minutes ago, is that once the outbreak was rolling, people really started cleaning. If they'd also started using bleach at that time, which I don't know if they did or not, and the outbreak stopped, people would say, well, maybe it was the bleach, but also, obviously, maybe it was just the increased thoroughness of some kind of cleaning. Hard to say. No studies have yet to evaluate confounders, such as prevalence density. So, again, we just don't know about the efficacy of various factors in environmental cleaning yet. Hopefully, we're going to be moving rapidly in this area because we can study it now. The intensity and thoroughness of cleaning while using bleach has never been evaluated, which I alluded to. And I just try to give an example here. For example, if the thoroughness of cleaning is at 30% and doesn't change, will you see an impact of bleach? In other words, if the cleaning isn't very good, will bleach work? Maybe. Maybe not. We don't know. On the other hand, if the thoroughness of cleaning is at 30% and increases to 80% when bleach is implemented and the norovirus in the environment significantly decreases, was it the bleach? Was it the improved cleaning? Or was it both? I think we have some interesting research potential opportunities to look at this. But nobody knows right now. Outbreaks are outbreaks, and by definition, they're finite. It's very, very hard when you're trying to study the efficacy of any intervention if you're dealing with a situation that is an outbreak situation, because all outbreaks, by definition, are finite. They're an increased incidence over a period of time that ends for one of many reasons, or probably many reasons at the same time. And so it's really hard to do any real studies in that kind of setting. And it's, therefore, much harder to do the kind of study you'd like to do, because you have to do a much more expensive study that takes much longer. Okay, going on to controlling healthcare norovirus outbreaks, a little bit about this issue of controlling. I talked about needing to have a high index of suspicion. That's very important. That's obvious. But it can be focused on. We do, at least in here in Massachusetts, have times when there's more norovirus going around than less, and more in healthcare settings than less. And so you can, educate people to have increased awareness from time to time. It's obviously hard to keep that edge of attention, but it's certainly worth trying to implement as is feasible. Reminders, as I say, to healthcare workers when outbreaks are in the community would be part of that. Rapid testing, I put in parentheses soon. There is now available in Europe, I believe, and I have not seen it yet in the U.S., but I did see it when I was at the European Congress in Vienna, a commercial kit that can give a rapid norovirus result that doesn't need PCR. It's basically like the C. diff rapid assay kits. It looks pretty sensitive. It's, as most of these kind of tools are, it's highly specific. A positive result is essentially always norovirus, but the sensitivity looks very nice in the few studies done with the support of the manufacturers that developed it, and I think it has to be studied further. But this would be obviously a very, very useful kit to have around to be able to rapidly diagnose when you start having a norovirus problem. It would be very handy. But maybe next time we talk about norovirus, we'll have more information about the kit, hopefully the rapid testing kit. Cohorting ill patients is certainly reasonable. But by the time you're doing that, of course, there's a lot of sick people around. It's hard to put two sick people, let's say, in a long-term care facility in the same room sometimes. It's just hard, very hard for management of the nursing staff. It can help decrease the environmental contamination by keeping those people cohorted and isolated, but it's challenging. Another approach to controlling is personnel control. I alluded to this before. Remaining out of work for 72 hours after your diarrhea and or vomiting has stopped is what the current recommendation is. Some places you'll see 48-72 hours recommended. But I think the critical thing is to remember that there's still a significant potential for shedding virus in folks for a number of days after that. Nobody knows exactly, how quickly the risk of transmission decreases, but it probably varies from individual to individual. But I think it's important to try to do the best we can. And I know that there's obviously pressure from the system to have people working rather than not working. So you have to dance a delicate dance with this issue, and there is no good guideline as to when a person is safe to come back to work. Maybe the kits will provide some interesting insights into that if they become used for that. Then we can check people like we did, let's say, for salmonella to have a couple of negative stools before allowing them back to work. But that hasn't even been talked about yet except in my mind and my thoughts. Other things for controlling, soap and water. It's clearly better than alcohol hand rubs, but obviously hard to implement. But it is recommended, and obviously it's worth trying to do to the degree it's feasible. Glove use for all patient contacts during outbreak, it's been discussed, but we're going to come to gloves in a second. Mobile and shared fomite control, I think this can be helpful, particularly in long-term care facilities, where you have to watch, because there are some areas that are common areas. There are some areas that things are shared, such as, let's say, a Hoyer lift, a very good example is a Hoyer lift, which people don't necessarily think to clean on a regular basis. But it's being moved between patient and patient. And, of course, the more ill patients, let's say with diarrhea, are going to use the Hoyer lift. And I know they're supposed to be clean, but are they being clean? It's up to people to know about that. What about closing admissions? We've done that at our hospital here with outbreaks on our adult psychiatric unit because of the difficulty in trying to manage norovirus in a setting like that with people always having to be moving around the unit. Restrict patient movement, obviously, again, a challenge, some settings more than others. And, environmental cleaning, we alluded to this reason to believe that better cleaning could be helpful. People talk about doing it as part of control. But it's sort of like, again, when the horse is out of the barn, if you have an outbreak, it's probably already too late to worry about environmental hygiene as being a big factor. It's not to say you shouldn't optimize it, and it shouldn't be good all the time, but on the other hand, it's probably not necessarily going to impact the outbreak very much at the time it's implemented in an outbreak setting. I said, forget the clocks. I had a picture, I'll come to that in a second, about remembering to focus on what's important when it comes to environmental hygiene. A little bit about gloves. Are gloves the answer? Well, they're nice for healthcare workers, but look at this little report, a very, very interesting and well thought out study by Dr. Barker and General Hospital Infections a couple of years ago. What they did is they went and used PCR to monitor serial transfer of human norovirus by fecal contaminated material on gloved fingertips. What they did is they took a specimen from a patient that had active norovirus infection. They diluted the specimen substantially, 1 to 5, so it wasn't exactly direct feces on the gloves. It was clear material on the gloves, and yet they were still able to transfer the norovirus through 4 transfers over and over from one to the other 100% of the time, and it was only after the 4th transfer that the ability to transfer started decreasing. And there was still enough norovirus on the glove to continue up to 7 times. 25% of the transfers were still possible at the 7th time. An illustration like this tells me how easy it is to move norovirus around the environment. It emphasizes the points we've made before and clarifies them. It's also interesting in the next slide that they did another part of the experiment by taking the first gloved hand and then going to doorknobs and things, and they were able to transfer after the first contact 4 out of 10, 40% of doorknobs, half of telephone receivers, 30% of sinks. So it was easy to give it to another gloved hand, very easy, but it was also fairly easy to give it to environmental surfaces. Maybe, again, not too surprising, but I think a good illustration of what we're talking about. Now, what about forget the clocks that I alluded to before? Yeah, what's wrong with this picture? Here's a couple of very, very carefully protected health care workers, environmental services folks, who are cleaning a room. It isn't necessarily norovirus, but look what they're cleaning. They're cleaning the wall, which is of almost no importance in the transmission of pathogens that we know of. And number two, they're cleaning the pillow. And while it's important to clean a pillow, because, of course, the pillowcase is not impervious by any means, half of their focus is in the wrong place in this photograph. So it's important to try to remember that when you're designing environmental services procedures, both for norovirus as well as for routine cleaning, that you really try to focus on what the high-risk surfaces are, the ones closest to the patient, the ones that can be contacted by the patient and by the healthcare worker, the critical ones. These are the ones that we've used in our studies that we've talked about last winter, and the further references can be given to you if you haven't seen those reports. I'm concerned because I sometimes see lists of what environmental services personnel are supposed to be cleaning on a daily basis or a terminal cleaning, and the lists are just unbelievably long. I mean, it's nice to clean the clocks, but from an infectious disease viewpoint, that's, you know, it's one thing. From an aesthetic viewpoint, it's something else. Yeah, the clock's dirty, dusty, okay, yeah, it should be cleaned. But on the other hand, is it important to stop a norovirus outbreak or prevent one from happening? I don't think so. The problem, again, no evidence-based interventions yet shown to be effective in controlling an outbreak. So what can we do to prevent norovirus outbreaks? The next slide reiterates the question. Norovirus outbreaks happen. We know that. There's no vaccine. There's no early diagnosis yet, and no confirmed means to control an outbreak. So when I was thinking about this, I thought that the only answer maybe due is to head for the moon, as I showed on the next slide there. How to prevent an outbreak is go to the moon for your next vacation, or maybe to Mars. I had fun getting these pictures. But more seriously, I think that what we have to do, if these aren't attractive, is we have no choice but to control the amplifier. We have to do better with the environment. Most hospitals and other healthcare settings are not currently being well cleaned. And this is about thoroughness, again, not necessarily about the product. Based on the earlier studies, and this is what I was alluding to before, that we've talked about last time, that when we looked at acute care hospitals using our targeting system, the DASO system, we 36 hospitals looked at. The overall cleaning was about 50%, and a little bit better than what we see on cruise ship restrooms, but the objects that weren't cleaned well have awful similarities to what we saw on cruise ships. We've now, by the way, looked at about 100 hospitals, in fact, over 100 hospitals of just terminal room cleaning, and this data is still just about exactly the same. It's running about 50 to 60% pre-intervention thoroughness of cleaning. So there is opportunity for improvement. I presented the next slide at the Atlanta Decennial in an abstract, and we'll hopefully be writing this up in the next few months. And what we did is I looked back at the various venues that we've been studying as to thoroughness of environmental cleaning in healthcare settings, and here's what we saw. This is pre-intervention. The first three show terminal room cleaning. The next is operating rooms, terminal room, operating room cleaning. The next room, next is neonatal intensive care units, terminal cleaning on discharge, EMS vehicles, ICUs, daily cleaning that's supposed to be done when people are on isolation, according to the CDC standards. So it's a study that's in ICUs, but it's looking at daily cleaning, not terminal cleaning. Clinics, long-term care facilities, nursing homes, and dialysis centers we're just starting to study now. And overall, you can see that the results are fairly similar, that with either daily cleaning or terminal cleaning, only about 34% of what should be cleaned according to the policies is being cleaned when checked using the fluorescent marking system. I have to remind everybody that there's an awful lot of work that went into this slide, essentially none of which was done by me, that 65,000 objects were evaluated to show this little bit of data on this one slide, and essentially I'd say over 90% were done by infection preventionists in various hospitals around the U.S. We have had some studies in Canada using our system and found similar results. But there's opportunity for improvement broadly in healthcare settings, and I think that what I would suggest, and I'm not going to be able to go into detail about it, is that we really need a new metric. The new metric that I ask all of you to look at and think about and critique and decide how relevant or not relevant it might be for your worlds is outlined in the article that was just published online yesterday in American Journal of Infection Control. It's a special part of a special supplement about a healthcare environment that has a couple of, I think, very important articles in it for healthcare and prevention and epidemiologists, healthcare epidemiologists, relating to some of the new environmental pathogens, Acinetobacter, C. diff, and norovirus. That article by David Weber and Bill Rutala and their group. There's a very fine review by Dr. Syed Sattar, one of our sponsors and co-founders of the webinar programs, that looks at the world of disinfectants and has some very, very interesting and thoughtful insights as to where we are now and where we're going to be heading with surface disinfectant issues. And then the final article was one that Dr. Judine Bartley and I put together that is similar to what I presented at the decennial presentation during the seminar, Environmental Hygiene Issues. And it raises, basically, the next slide, the question of where we are between conventional programs and what we're suggesting, you know, should be considered as enhanced programs to evaluate environmental cleaning and the monitoring of environmental cleaning. That basically traditional programs are, as outlined here, are subjective, the visual assessments, they're deficiency-oriented, and are problem detection feedback-oriented. The enhanced programs that we're suggesting should be considered move to an objective quantitative assessment. They're performance-oriented rather than deficiency-oriented. They rely on a cyclic monitoring model. The performance feedback is objective rather than subjective. This has all gone into in more detail, and I won't belabor these next slides with all the fine print, except to say that there are advantages of both models. The established model is established. The traditional infection control, environmental hygiene rounds, and look at the hospital and see how it looks. A type of approach has been done for many years. The new enhanced program has advantages, but also some challenges and limitations, as noted on the next slide. I think from what I've been seeing and where we've been implementing these programs, the major issue is that it's just something new and that it requires sort of a new program development within an institution, which is challenging. It's certainly been very doable, but it takes some dedication, it takes some leadership, and it takes some energy to implement such programs. And they're not, this such input and such necessity is not being discounted by us at all. And lastly, there are some potential monitoring tool issues. Some tools work better than other tools. Some tools are applicable for certain things, like outbreak situations that are particularly useful, such as culturing. All this has gone into in the review article that you should be able to get through the American Journal of Infection Control through their website if you're an APIC member. And I don't know about accessibility if you're not an APIC member yet, but if you aren't, it's a good opportunity to say, okay, now's the time to join, because I think you'll find a number of parts of this as well as the journal itself to be worthwhile. So in conclusion, I think it's really likely that surfaces in the patient's zone are highly relevant in the transmission of healthcare-associated pathogens, including norovirus. We didn't have time today to go over some of the evolving data on the other pathogens and the role of the environment in terms of C. diff, Acinetobacter, MRSA, and VRE, all of which are significant environmental pathogens, and the fact that more and more data is evolving to support this and show the importance of the environment in these with these pathogens. And so that I'd like to say, while optimizing hand hygiene and isolation practices are clearly important, and I don't mean to downplay hand hygiene, it certainly is very important, it's just that it isn't a complete answer in and of itself. An isolation practice, we didn't talk about that because, except sort of indirectly with the norovirus, because it's so hard to isolate patients that come down with this disease abruptly, although obviously they should be on contact precautions. But even when you're optimizing those, we really have to also optimize environmental hygiene, I think. This is basically the conclusion of our presentation today. I'll turn it back to Paul for further comments.
Dr. Carling, thank you very much for that. You reminded me of something. Several years ago, I had occasion to go to a conference of cruise ship physicians, and they invited me to speak at that. And unfortunately, it was on a cruise of the Caribbean for a week. And so my lecture being just 1 hour long left me with a great deal of time. Anyway, it was very interesting that many of the representatives from the cruise ships were very keen to point out that norovirus is in the community. It's not a cruise ship problem. Yep. It's a community problem. Yep. And that seemed to be quite an overriding theme amongst the speakers from the specific cruise ships. And what would be the significance of removing salt and pepper shakers from tables?
Well, in hopes that the passenger with the norovirus on their hands due to suboptimal personal hygiene does not contaminate the salt and pepper shaker that then somebody else is going to use and acquire the infection that way.
That's a bit of a read.
I would think so. And that's when the nurse thought so too. That's why she pointed out that observation. That was sort of curious.
Well,
a little too late.
Well, listen, thank you again very much. And thanks to Virox for their support of this teleclass and of our teleclass program. Thank you all for joining us today. And Dr. Carling, thank you again for what was a tremendous presentation. And I look forward to inviting you and hopefully getting an okay from you to invite you to speak again at teleclasses in the future. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome, Paul. My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll talk to you all again very soon. Goodbye.